Coming to you direct from the nerve center of the galaxy's greatest comic. This is the 2000 AD Thrillcast.
Borak Thung, Earthlets, and welcome to the latest episode of the 2000 AD Thrillcast Lockdown Tapes, broadcasting from a very stormy Oxford on this autumn day. I'm your host, as always, Molchar, and on this episode we're talking The Dark Judges, and specifically Deliverance, which is the series that's currently running in the Judge Dredd magazine. We've got the creative team, David Hine and Nick Percival, on to talk about their version of the fearsome foursome. What's in store for them in this story, and just some of the ideas that have informed both their approach to The Dark Judges and also horror and gore and things like that. Really interesting chat about their process, both Nick as an artist and David as a writer-artist. So it's fantastic to be able to talk to them. As always, do let us know what you would like to listen to on the 2000 AD Thrillcast, now that it is weekly, burning through material. Thrillcast@2000ad.com. That's Thrillcast, all one word, at 2000ad.com. Thank you for the feedback we've had so far. Lots more in store this year. So we will crack on with our feature interview with Nick and with David, where we talk about Judge Dredd. No, we don't. We talk about The Dark Judges, Deliverance. Welcome both to the podcast, for both for the first time, I think.
Yeah.
Yes, right. Okay. We want to talk about Dark Judges Deliverance, which is the series you've got running at the moment in the Judge Dredd magazine. Do you want to start off, because this isn't your first series working together on the Dark Judges. Do you want to, David, do you want to explain a little bit about how you came to be working on the Fearsome Foursome?
Yeah, okay. Originally, John Wagner had started writing the story. What was his called? Dominion,
I believe, was
his story. And he basically left it where almost everyone on the planet was dead, and Roscoe was the only survivor. Matt Smith just contacted me and said, "Do you want to take it over and see what you can do with the concept?" And it was an interesting one, because I haven't written for 2000 AD since the mid-90s. So it was pretty cool to be back on doing The Dark Judges, you know, because they're a lot of fun. So the thing is, though, The Dark Judges are a weird set of characters, because it's almost like, you know, Superman has got too many superpowers. He's too strong, so you have to get a gimmick to weaken him. And I always feel that's the way with the Dark Judges. You can't kill them, and they're going to keep on killing until the entire human race is gone. So you have to find some way to stop them. I guess the original gimmick with Torture Garden was that, first of all, they're addicted to killing. So they couldn't kill everyone at once, because then they have no one left and they're stuck on the planet. So they kind of ration themselves. And secondly, what do Dark Judges do in their downtime? I've kind of figured, well, maybe they're into art. So we had this whole thing where they were like creating sculptures, and Judge Death was getting into really dark Gothic literature and that kind of stuff. Baudelaire. We just kind of took it from there. And Nick was great to work with, because, you know, when we actually came to do, they built a city. And I said, have a look at Gaudi and his architecture in Barcelona, and kind of take it from there. And I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about that, Nick, how you...
Yeah, well, a lot of it, obviously you put a lot of it in the script, and were kind enough to attach various visual, you know, references and so on and whatnot. But I think, obviously, with the city and everything, it was obviously the garden itself, it was just a way of using the corpses and all the zombies that had been previously killed and were still being killed by the Dark Judges, using them to actually make them part of the architecture, part of the garden. Everything's entwined together, you know, so their anatomy is blending into the foliage, into the architecture itself. It just became one big mass of, you know, of bodies and architecture and so on. And it's visually, I thought, you know, it was great for me, because it was just, I mean, you know, obviously in Dominion, the first book, it was pretty much like a homage to every zombie film, you know, comic book going. And it was great to do the traditional kind of Walking Dead style zombies. But what was nice about Torture Garden was the continuation of that was, they kind of evolved. So in a sense, they were still undead, but you had the visuals where you could combine all the plants and the, you know, all the vines and everything. It was just, yeah, it was great. And also it could bring a lot of colour into it as well, you know, because everything's a bit more moody and grey in the first book. And then this, because of that, you know, you could bring lots of greens and reds. And you, so in a sense, you've got this grotesque imagery, yet you've actually got quite a nice colour palette, which I thought was quite an interesting way to approach it.
Yeah, I think we're going to go further with that, because in the new series, we've got Roscoe surviving, and although I did my best to destroy the Dark Judges and get rid of them for at least 10 years, Matt insisted on bringing them back after only a year. Right. So we this time we've got a Judge Whisper who kind of gets infected by the blood orchids. So that whole idea of you've got a dark judge, he's all grey and like cadaverous, but with all these beautifully colourful flowers growing out. And I really liked that contrast.
Yeah. Also, like the way, and again, he's constantly growing and evolving as well. So we've got him, I mean, it's not a spoiler, but there's going to be rain later on, a storm, in a sense, which actually nourishes his organs and plants and whatnot. And I'm actually working on part 7 at the moment, but I've actually managed to combine a couple of pages to do a double page spread. So it's going to be a really nice image of him when he's praising the rain, and he's going to grow and evolve and whatnot. You know, so that should be quite cool when I get around to painting it. So
I'm looking forward to that. Yeah, we don't want to give away too much about what's going to happen, because there's only 2 episodes so far have come out. But yeah, Judge Whisper goes through changes. He basically, because he had half his brain blown away, he's gone. His mind is not what it was, basically. So
it's been a challenge, I guess, that John Wagner and Alan Grant came up against with the Dark Judges is that the original mission was so one note, it's so final. And we've seen various that, you know, Alan went, John, for better or for worse, turned them into slightly comedic characters. Alan went back in time to explore the origins of the Dark Judges in the Half-Life storyline. And then you've got the other approach that was the Dwayne Szczerski series for IDW, where, I mean, he sextupled the number of Dark Judges with various different things.
No, I didn't see that.
is this the challenge of doing something different with characters that basically have one purpose?
Yes, I mean that's exactly why I thought, well, let's explore some other aspects of that character, the addiction to killing, and also to explore, you know, what might actually go on inside their minds. But I am enjoying Judge Whisper, because he's just not like other Dark Judges.
Yeah, you know? No, I love that character.
He's not quite sure of his mission at all. But I have said this. So it's like, I can imagine us finishing this series and Matt coming back in another 6 months saying, okay, let's do another one. And it's this kind of, how do you keep on bringing them back and giving a story a satisfactory conclusion? And it's not an obvious thing to do, because, as you said, Mike, they have such a single minded purpose. And I have said I would love to just do the final Dark Judges story where they literally exterminate all life throughout the known universe. That and you know, the end, the fucking end, that's it.
There are enduringly popular characters, you know, it's not difficult to see that just even on things like social media. You know, we post a picture of Judge Death and so iconic is that character that it immediately gets a response. Do you to a certain extent feel the weight of that kind of continuity, the weight of all that's come before, not just in terms of script, but also in terms of art, because obviously these are characters created by Brian Bolland, who's...
Yeah. To me, like I've said a few times before, Brian Bolland obviously is the ultimate version of those characters. You know, that can't be bettered. And to be honest, when Judge Death was the first comic book character that actually scared me as a kid. You know, I grew up on the Marvel stuff and then sort of dipped in and out of 2000 AD. And I remember seeing the original Judge Death story. And it was just, again, it was just so menacing. You know, it was like you really did feel that it was a dangerous kind of character. So that stayed with me. And obviously, this is now my third kind of volume dealing with the characters. And each time they've looked a little bit different. But I purposely wanted to do that because, you know, his designs are so iconic. I didn't want to do a complete copy. It was more like, you know, I wouldn't go there because I couldn't do any better. And I know a few artists have kind of stuck along those, you know, really, really stuck to the visuals, and some have messed around with it a bit. So it was really kind of taking what was iconic to me about those designs and putting my own sort of spin and style on it. It kind of helped with the story as well to some degree, because I think certainly at the beginning of Dominion, they'd been kind of damaged anyway. They were floating through space. They'd been destroyed. So it gave a good starting point to kind of re-outfit them a little bit, redesign them just a little bit in a sense of what they've been through all this time, you know, make them evolve. And again, in the torture gardens, that thing where they get in the first episode, I think, they get basically almost completely blown apart. And then they end up in the sort of regenerating health sleep type machines on that are in the labs. So again, when they emerge from that, it's another excuse in a sense that they can look a little bit different. So that, from an artistic point of view, that's great for me because it keeps me sort of really interested. And it sort of covers my back a bit that I'm not trying to copy Brian Bolland. I'm not trying to do, you know, like a painted version of Brian Bolland or whatever, you know, that he's like the master as far as I'm concerned. So it is daunting, but I think now being that far into it, you know, I think I was counting the other day. I think I've probably around about over 250 pages I've painted now with the Dark Judges. So I really do feel close to them now. You know, I really feel like, you know, really, and I've got my favourites and so on. And it's, you know, I'm really sort of finding my way with them. So, yeah, but again, you know, I wouldn't sort of touch the ball and stuff. It's just amazing.
Yeah. I have noted that you've each time we work together, you've said, can we figure out a way of like redesigning the judges again? Because we will be doing that in this series as well. So I really get the feeling that you got...
But there's always there's a story element that justifies it. And again, yeah, there is in this version. So it's not just like we're doing it for the sake of it. It's not happened yet. But obviously in the new series, there's a good reason for that. And I think that's what's good. You know, it's justified. It actually plays into the story as well. So that's cool as well.
What are your artistic influences on the Dark Judges stuff that you're doing?
It's a weird one because, like I say, Bolland's obviously a starting point, so you're still having the portcullis type thing on Death, and you know, and then the skull for Mortis. So all those iconic elements are there. And I don't really know. I mean, obviously, again, you're going to get that difference because my stuff is fully painted as well, so it's going to look different to obviously the black and white stuff. So you've got the advantage of you can bring a colour scheme in for each character as well, you know, and. And again, that was a decision like with Judge Fire, when I sort of was approaching him, I was making him more sort of blue, like blue flame, again, just to make it a little bit different, you know, because we've got the advantage of fully painted colour. But yeah, I mean, my influences come visually from outside that, you know. I'm always a big fan of, say, Frank Frazetta, you know, famous fantasy artist, and, you know, a lot of art. And again, how he approaches colour, you know, his stuff's very sort of colourful, and he'll use spot colours in various places for various effects and so on. Yeah, it's and a lot of film, to be honest. I think these series, as I've looked a lot more at film, in just terms of some of the lighting and some of the, you know, sort of how to compose it. I've tried to give it a bit of a widescreen sort of feel, quite cinematic, which helps with David's scripts, because David's scripts are very, they really like screenplays, you know, and the pace, very sort of punchy how they're paced and so on. I mean, you'll know when, you know, how when to go to wide or a close up and so on. And it just kind of, from, you know, it's a pleasure to work with, really, because it's, the scripts flow so well. When you read them and when I start laying out the pages, it feels very cinematic. I mean, obviously, because Dave, you're an artist yourself, so I presume some of that comes from you're visualizing it more so when you're writing it.
Yeah, I always, to this day, I always do thumbnails as I'm doing the scripts, which you won't see, because I always feel it's a bit, it's pinning you down too much. If I show you thumbnails, it's going to get stuck in your head. I'd rather you have a, but I do that just so that I can figure out that it is going to work. So I'll kind of sketch out camera angles, close-ups, how many panels to the page. And I know you also like to have at least one full page spread every issue, so I'll try to work one of those in.
Which, that's one advantage of being in the magazine, I think, because we've got 10 pages per episode. You're not forced to squeeze everything into 5 or 6 pages, so you can have a little bit of pacing. You know, you can have those moments where you're going to turn the page and it's going to be a big splash page kind of shock moment. You know, you can build to that. Whereas in 2000 AD, and certainly when I worked on scripts, it's through no fault of anybody there, but because you're limited to 5 or 6 pages per episode, there's a lot to cram in that you know, you can have a scene change and it's on a separate page. I hate scene changes where it's on the same page. I think that never works in a short form storytelling. You know, it's nice to break, and it just adds for more of a flow. Like I say, we've got the advantage of the 10 page per episode format. And from an art point of view, that just gives you a bit more room to breathe.
I must say that there certainly is, working as a writer in various different formats, you go through kind of switch modes in your head. If you're doing an American comic book, which is likely to be 20 pages, and even that can seem like cramming too much in sometimes. And then the 6-page stories for 2000 AD. I remember when I was writing stuff for 2000 AD back in the 90s. My God, to have to make, because you still want to be a kind of self-contained block within the story. And to do that in 6 pages is incredibly difficult. It does make for that very, as you say, punchy kind of storytelling. Mm. Whereas if you're doing a full graphic novel, which I've done with people like Mark Stafford, you know, 150 pages, you can really relax and just, and then get very cinematic. You know, that is, to be honest, my favorite way of scripting. The magazine, 10 pages seems about right, actually, for each episode. I think it works pretty well.
Yeah. In terms of the writing for this, are there specific things that you are drawing on? Because I'm thinking about the kind of pseudo-religious elements that have made their way into Deliverance. Is that something that's intentional? Is that kind of the best direction to go in for something like this? You know, playing with ideas like that.
I'm certainly interested in cults and death cults, like, you know, the Jonestown cult where over 900 people commit, well, suicide, enforced suicide. I can show you, this is one of my big influences on this one, The Imitation of Christ by Thomas A. Kempis. Thomas A. Kempis was the most miserable bastard who ever lived. And this whole book is just telling Christians how life is suffering. It's awful. You know, if you're actually having any pleasure whatsoever in your life, then you must be doing something wrong. You know? So I kind of, there's bits and pieces. We've got a character called Kempis.
Yeah.
And some of his dialogue is actually more or less quoted straight from Thomas A. Kempis. I did enjoy that.
I mean, Kempis was writing one of the most miserable periods in human history. So, you know.
Yeah. Oh, and of course, we've got an element of Buddhism coming in. We haven't actually introduced yet, have we?
No, part 4, I think.
Okay. Let me just say,
I was bizarre when I read the script for that, actually, because again, it was one of these things where obviously I'm reading it page by page, and I get to the last page, and it's like, what's David on? You know what I mean? It just gets more and more surreal as I was going along. So yeah, it worked out well.
I have to say, I think you were talking earlier, Michael, about whether people go for the humorous approach or the dark approach. And what I'm trying to do, and I hope I've succeeded, is write a story that's incredibly dark, but also makes you chuckle.
I think that's the thing. I mean, that's the thing for when the dark judges themselves have been treated kind of like pantomime characters for whatever reasons, you know, whether it was just a case of, you know, wanting to do something different. I just, you know, it just takes away that dangerous element. So even there's a lot of humor in Deliverance, but it's never at the expense of like Judge Death. I mean, they're still, those characters, they're taken kind of seriously. But, you know, and how much they're feared and so on, but it's the kind of characters around them and the absurdity of the situation to some extent. It's almost like a Monty Python type feel to some of it, which is great. But when they get down to things like the killing and whatever, it's gruesome and it's not comical in that sense. You know, it's kind of like played straight, but it's the kind of characters around them that sort of balance it out. And I think that's the perfect combination, because people are saying, oh, you know, you can't make them funny. And I think, to be honest, there's got to be some humour in there, you know, and it, like I say, it doesn't have to be from Judge Death walking around wearing a dress and doing that kind of stuff. You know, the humour comes from the characters around them and the kind of craziness of the situation that they're actually in. But there's still a real threat, and there's real danger, and there's real, you know, real stakes, so to speak.
Well, we've got Archbishop Firk, who is an alien Mortarian. The Mortarians, basically, they hate themselves so much, they're constantly physically abusing themselves. And Firk went over the top when he was younger and stuck all these spikes through his neck. So the only sound he can make is basically Firk, and various variations on Firk, which I just find hilariously funny.
Yeah, well, it works.
Yeah, there's a few characters that are pretty. Everything is just full on with this series, I think.
We had a podcast episode just recently where we were talking about the Screaming Mrs. Special, and we were talking about we're exploring how comics do horror, and one of the obvious ways that comics can do horror is gore. Yeah. And body horror, and this is definitely one of those series that falls into that category. I just wanted to get your thoughts on A, body horror as a genre, and B, is there a process of desensitization when you are producing stuff like this, or is there a kind of weird oversensitization that you're constantly looking for new ways to freak people out?
I think from a visual point of view, I mean, as far as gore goes, you know, as a genre, so to speak, if you want, you know, I've never been like a massive fan of gore. So in films, I can, you know, I'll take it or leave it. You know, I've much more prefer the sort of more suspense or classic spooky sort of films of creatures, that kind of thing, rather than just a load of gore. But it doesn't actually freak me out. I know some people literally can't watch anything if there's a bit of blood or a bit of gore in it. You know, that it's never bothered me in that sense. So, I'm not squeamish. And then from an artistic point of view, you know, obviously I spent 2 years doing Hellraiser covers and things like that. So, I mean, that was obviously, you know, all the, you know, the kind of torturous kind of side of gore and so on. And certainly with the Dark Judges, I mean, visually it's interesting to do. Because, you know, you've got the reds and you've got the sort of ways of... You're right, you do need to come up with ways of how to do it. There's so many different ways of killing zombies or depicting that kind of thing. You know, you do become desensitized because, you know, sometimes you do have to catch yourself. I can zoom in on something I'm painting on the screen and it's somebody's innards spilling everywhere and I'm there doing little highlights and specular things. And, you know, you're treating it as a piece of art, probably not really thinking what it, the content of what you're actually producing, which I suppose could be a bit suspect. But you know, I'd literally just treat it as a piece of art and part of the storytelling process. But it's, I think it's quite an easy thing to do. I think much harder is built, certainly in a comic book form. I think building things like suspense is quite difficult to do, certainly with the amount of pages maybe you've got and, you know, and how much room you've got to play with. So that's quite hard. Gore is always kind of an in-your-face kind of element, but you know, it's trying to make ways to find it maybe a bit more visually interesting and not do the kind of over-the-top kind of comical eyeballs flying out the heads type thing. I think it's a bit more making it you know, more sort of grounded. If that makes any sense at all.
I must say, I've been watching The Boys, and it did get to, I've enjoyed it a lot, but I did get to the point where I was saying, if I see one more exploding head. But talking about over-the-top gore, I did write a few series for Crossed, and my instruction on that book, which came from William Christensen, the publisher, was basically push it further than we've gone to this point. And I was like, further? I mean, if you know The Cross, it's pretty over the top.
Yeah.
Anyway, so it was kind of weird. I did used to set myself the goal of breaking my own barriers of good taste. Like, can I go further than this? And I think I look back on that work, and I'm not entirely sure about it now.
I mean, that is a very good series to kind of question the nature of horror, because, you know, you look at the people who had worked on Crossed, Garth Ennis, obviously, yourself, David, David Lapham, and yeah. Cy Spurrier, and it did feel like there was a scale between those who, like David Lapham, where it was very, very intense. You know, there wasn't a page that hadn't got something pretty disgusting on it. Whereas Garth and Cy Spurrier seemed to be much more the kind of a strategic deployment of that gore.
Yeah.
If you see what I mean.
Just excuse me for one second. It's just started raining torrentially. I think I may have water coming. I'm just going to close
it. Going on your comics, on your spinner rack. Protect it.
That may well be the storm that passed through Oxford about an hour ago, where it was, yeah, there, we've got some big trees out near the playing fields just there, and they were virtually kind of over to the side with the wind, which is...
You're just going to cut back to David and everything's just going to be drenched.
Yeah, it's going to be dark.
You're all right. Safe?
Yeah, I'm safe now.
Go.
Miss anything?
No. It was just that kind of that scale, using Crossed as an example, but I guess it's a very good scale for any kind of horror, where particularly with gore, you can deploy it very, very like surgically, or you can just throw it at the reader, as it were. And where do you feel your Dark Judges work sits on that spectrum?
Go on.
From my point of view, I know I have seen it. Your style does lend itself to gore.
Yeah.
So I certainly felt like it was the way to go. I mean, I think we would have gone that way anyway. But your gore is kind of, it has an aesthetic all of its own. It's got a kind of beauty to it. You know, all those spilled guts do actually kind of look quite appealing if you have a certain...
Well, yeah, I mean, like I say, it is a final image at the end of the day. I mean, it is a piece, you know, a piece of art. So you are thinking about, you know, the composition and the colour blends and so on. I think, like you were saying about Crossed, or the issues that, or the ones that were produced maybe by, you know, weren't done by Garth and some, you know, the better talents or whatever. Or when you do see it in some of the various... American comic books and so on, it can be done in a very tacky way. It's just there, and especially if there's violence, you know, to women in it and so on, it's a horrible, you know, it's how it's actually treated. I mean, obviously a lot of ours is depicted on undead characters for a start, so but from the art point of view and in the Dark Judges stuff, I mean, it's very I just think of it really as from a composition point of view, and how it just looks as a page and how it works, and it's not just kind of like slapped in there, you know, for the sake of it. It really is sort of like part of the storyline, and, you know, and it really does sort of, you know, it really does come together as a whole, you know, at the end of the day.
Hear this? The torrential rain landing on my...
Yeah.
It's looking, quite dodgy out there.
Yeah, it's raining.
It's the end of the world. I knew it was coming.
I mean, you're not wrong. Just not in a position, not necessarily in this exact moment. One thing I did want to ask about was is escalation. And the whether, and I kind of touched on this already, but whether there's a diminishing return with horror, that you have to keep on upping the ante the longer on you go. And I wondered what the challenges were for both of you in kind of overcoming that challenge, and whether you feel that there still needs to be some place to go that you don't go in a series like this.
I keep the brakes on to a certain extent, but I think as far as escalation goes, it's more to do with the characterization. If you're identifying with the characters, if you can make them sympathetic in some way, then that's what will make the tension, the drama escalate, is if you care about the characters. It's not the degree of pain that they suffer or whatever. It's how much you actually care about the characters. So I think that's really the challenge, is to keep making sympathetic characters who aren't necessarily great people. You know, they can be. I think I even kind of feel a kind of sympathy for Judge Death. Judge Death more than the others. I have to admit, one of my failings is I haven't really been able to get into the separate personalities maybe of some of the other dark judges.
Yeah.
Because we created him, and Judge Death because he's the core character. But yeah. The others, I guess I'm still seeing them a little bit as ciphers.
It would be nice to, like I say, if we do another one, it would be maybe nice to think about that, because I mean, Judge Death, again, you know, I think these past two books I've done with you, I mean, it really has got into his personality much more, and the motivations and so on, which is, you know, I find really interesting. And the other characters, you do feel like they're basically, they are, you know, there is support, there is gang, there's supporting cast and so on. It would be, I mean, it's a lot to throw around as well, because obviously we've got the human characters like Roscoe, you know, the lead female. I mean, that's just the third book with her now, and I think she's really developed as a character. And it's nice that we can keep referring to things that have happened previously as well. You know, I think she's a great character. I love, you know, working on her. And obviously you've introduced, or will be introducing, a whole new bunch of characters in part three. I think we see a new bunch of people who are going to be there.
Wild kids.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, and again, they've got their, you know, their own sort of distinct little personalities as well. So we are juggling quite a big cast, really, at the end of the day. So I always equate it to like doing a team book, you know, where people always said, oh, yeah, it was easy to work on things like Spider-Man because it was like a singular character. And then, oh, it's really hard to work on the X-Men, whatever, because it's a lot more work. I mean, it's a lot more work for the writer because you're juggling these characters. It's a lot more work for the artist because you've got multiple characters in panels, which is, you know, he's trying to make it interesting. It's quite a lot of work, but I really feel like working on one massive team book. And as far as the, you know, Judge Fire, Mortis, and what's the other one? Fear. yeah, it would be quite nice to maybe, you know, look at that possibly as a sort of, you know, a follow on or to some extent, but I mean, visually, they're all great because they all work together. But I've not read everything that's been done with the Dark Judges, so I don't know how much attention has been paid to those characters in the past anyway.
I haven't read everything either. I dug out a whole bunch of stuff when I started doing this, so certainly most of the earlier stuff I've read. Mm. But I can't remember seeing a lot of in-depth stuff for...
I mean, I know there's been bits and bobs, but something, like I said, with Death, I feel like we really have got into his head, and it's great, you know, because you see some of his motivations challenged as well, certainly in the Torture Garden, you know, it was, you know, it gave him, I mean, at the end of the day, he was still going to go and kill everybody, that was never going to change, but it was quite nice that he actually sort of thought about, oh, hang on a minute, why am I doing this? Oh yeah, it's because of this, but I still want to kill everybody, yeah. So it was just quite nice to sort of see him pause a little bit and, you know, have a little think.
Actually, it is interesting, as you know, with this story, I was kind of toying with giving it a happy ending.
I don't know how it ends yet, so
I won't tell you how it ends, but I Remember, I was saying, you know, I really want to have a really kind of hippie-ish kind of feel. And Matt was like, yeah, okay, but everybody dies, right?
God.
Like, everybody must die. So there is that. There is that kind of the ultimate end has to be that. He's absolutely right. I mean, you can't have them all dancing off into the sunset, unfortunately.
Has there been a female dark judge at all? Has that ever been done? A female dark judge?
No, there's the sisters, of course.
Yeah, well, yeah, I know the sisters, but I mean an actual dark judge.
I don't think so.
I don't think so. Aside from what...
like a female host body, so we actually had a female kind of dark judge.
Oh, well, yeah, Death took over an old lady's body. Oh,
yeah, I know, that was in the heyday of the... Yeah. Yeah. But you know what I mean, a real kind of proper own sort of character or anything, or...
None is immediately springing to mind.
Well, there you go.
I'm sure we'll be corrected in the comments.
So we can do a marriage. Our next one can be Judge Death and a Bride or something.
Yeah, the Bride of Death.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, that's got possibilities.
One thing I did want to ask about was, and this is something that the character has struggled with before, is Death is an extrapolation of Dread. He is, you know, a perverted twisting of Dread as a character. And Dread and then Anderson have always acted as counterpoints to Death. Is it difficult to remove that counterpoint and still have Judge Death make sense as a character?
You mean to write stories where the actual Judge Dread hasn't appeared at all in any of these? No, I wouldn't have looked forward to doing this with Judge Dredd. It's a little bit like writing Batman. Yeah, there's not very much you can really do with the character anymore, I think. So I was far happier to introduce new characters going up against Death than to do yet another Dredd versus Death. I know everyone, it's like there are key characters that everyone wants to write. And in this country, that would, I guess, be Judge Dredd. But I honestly couldn't think of a single thing that you could do with him now. I mean, how many, we've got 2,000 issues of 2000 AD or more?
2,205 this week.
You know, it's, I'm amazed actually that there are still entertaining stories coming out. With featuring Judge Dredd, it's been pretty amazing.
I think it's given us more freedom though, to some extent, you know, because the fact that it doesn't have to be Mega City One, it doesn't have to be Dredd and Judges and so on, it's just given us freedom to do, you know, basically whatever we want. I mean obviously the fans will always know that he's a mirror of Dredd or whatever, but I think Death's can, you know, has moved beyond that in terms of being able to do solo adventures, and it's quite nice to see other people's first reactions to him as well. So he's, you know, we're introducing new characters who haven't encountered Judge Death before. So they're seeing him for the first time. Everything's kind of fresh, where if it's the Mega City One, it's Judge Death again. You know, I think, I mean, at some point, I mean, it probably won't be, guess it won't be us, but at some point, I'm sure Matt will want to get them back together and have another face off. But again, it has been done and it would have to be done quite differently. And I think in the meantime, there's no, you know, there's a whole bunch of stories you can do with the Dark Judges, and it's quite nice to have them, you know, with characters that haven't interacted with them before and don't know maybe what the threat is when they first encounter him.
Well, I like the fact that Death's nemesis in these stories is Roscoe, who is a very ordinary person. She has no great skills, or certainly not combat skills. And it's just her... she just doesn't give up. I mean, that's what we've established as the core of Roscoe, is she does not give up. She's a survivor and she will keep on going. And I find that more interesting than a character like Judge Dredd, who is just like full on in your face. I'm happy to carry on with Roscoe as the main.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
One thing I always find really interesting about Judge Death, particularly in later years, is he's a failure.
not only
is he not, you know, destroyed Mega City 1, but he's not even the greatest killer when he's on Earth. Like, Dredd is responsible for, you know, 1.5 billion deaths, which in comparison to death is just completely overwhelmed his total. With the character lines, it feels to a certain extent like, certainly since Dark Justice and Dominion and Torture Garden and now Deliverance, that simplicity, that basic essence of death is something that you've had to not necessarily move beyond, but develop much more. So he makes more sense, if you see what I mean.
Yes. I suppose it's the idea of a character who sees all life as sinful. I mean, originally as law breaking, but law and sin has become kind of synonymous. I mean, that's why I bring in the religious elements. And I think there is probably something in human nature that finds, death has got this attraction. I mean, all civilizations have their apocalyptic legends. There's almost wishful thinking. Let's have the final Armageddon. You see it now. You know, there are all kinds of cults and conspiracy theorists who seem to want this final conflict. It's that kind of Thanatopian thing and you see it in Marvel movies. Everybody wants that final apocalypse where everyone gets wiped out. I suppose that's the attraction of Judge Death, if you really get down to it. Death and annihilation does have a weird appeal.
I want to turn on to happier subjects now, specifically about how you produce your work, Nick, because, you were working for 2080 back in the 90s.
Yeah, yeah.
Where you were doing, you were part of that kind of...
Learning to paint brigade. I think that's the word you're looking for.
I didn't want to say, like, I'm guided by the way that people describe themselves, but you know, I've spoken to people like, you know, Carl Critchlow, Dermot Power, people specifically bought in, and I'd love to speak to like Dean Ormston at one point in the future, where it was, let's describe what it was the post Bisley.
Yeah.
Age at 2000.
Yeah, I mean, we're all late. I think Bisley had such an impact and on the slain, you know, there's a colour work when it came out. And it's weird why we all went that way to some extent, because you would have thought, why even attempt painted comics? Because surely black and white stuff is easier. You know, it's like, when did we suddenly just think we could paint? You know, it's one of the things where, I mean, obviously everyone loved it, but it, to me, it's still bizarre why I even, you know, because as a kid, obviously I was doing black and white stuff. I've sent stuff to 2000 AD when I was 17. I've got the rejection letter still to prove it, you know, and that was black and white line art, you know, and obviously wasn't good enough. But then when the slain stuff came out, suddenly we all suddenly thought, oh, we'll try painting then, which is stupid really, because it's a massively complex process, you know, to just paint, you know, especially when you're looking at the caliber of that work. But that's the way that a lot of us went. And obviously, you know, you could look at his work and you could see some of the techniques of how he actually painted a page. And obviously we were using similar ways of doing it. So we were doing the same techniques, obviously just nowhere near as good. But I don't know. I mean, I'm grateful to get the work, you know, when I did for the magazine in 2000 in the 90s. But I think the thing is, like a lot of us then, you were making all your mistakes in public. You were just learning as you were going along. And you got better and better, like you're forced to do when you get deadlines and you have to produce a lot of work. You just, I guess it does separate maybe some people who can handle it or not. And you do get better. But it was a weird time. It was a weird time for a lot. Everybody's changed since then. You know, all the people that you mentioned, and everyone's evolved and changed style since then. It's like a learning ground, but you know, some better than others and whatever. But unfortunately, we just kind of had to make those kind of mistakes in public. And obviously, from my point of view, slowly moved more into digital art, but again, still making it painterly, you know, still using all the techniques you do when you normally paint, but just using digital tools to do that. So yeah, that was a weird time, but I mean, now it's just now it seems to have gone back pretty much to the other way, to be honest. Not a lot of people do painted comics now. It seems to have flipped and gone back more to line art with computer coloring or whatever. I mean, I think the Dark Judges stuff lends itself very well to painted stuff because it is all about atmosphere and texture and mood, and you know, which is something that, you know, painted stuff lends itself really, really well to, and you can be very cinematic then with your lighting effects and so on. So as an artistic choice for these volumes, I think it's the perfect route to go. But it's certainly a strange time.
Explain a little bit about how you form a page, because you know, if you're working traditionally, then there's obviously the penciling stage, the inking stage, colouring stage.
I mean, it's very similar. I mean, I still draw. I mean, I've only got a crappy sort of Wacom pad that I do the colouring with. I know a lot of people have got Cintiq and they do all the drawing, you know, that do the drawings as well digitally. I still draw traditionally on like large, I draw big, so you got big sort of A2, A1 size sheets of card basically. And I will draw with pencil the whole page out. So you've got a traditional penciled, albeit very rough, but penciled comic page. You know, they exist. So I've got hundreds of pages of Dark Judges and Dread and whatnot, you know, of original pencils. Then I'll scan it in. And then obviously all the digital process takes over. Then it becomes like a painting process, but digitally. And I tend to separate each panel separately. So I'll take the panel, each panel I'm working on, and treat that as a kind of individual painting. But the techniques there are literally the same as I would have done when I was painting. So it's like a dark undercoat over the painting, sort of building the colours up and the tones, and think about the light sources and so on, but just using Photoshop and Painter tools to do that. And then obviously, once all the panels are done, I'll put them back on the page, you know, over the original pencil, so it looks again like a comic page. And then I can take a look how the whole page looks as a whole. Because when you're working on these panels individually, sometimes you put them together on the whole page and some of it, like the colour tones, don't sort of, you know, match and so on. So then I'll take the page as a whole and give it kind of like a once over and polish to make sure everything kind of matches nicely and, you know, everything sort of fits together. And, you know, that's the finished page. So the techniques are the same as when I was painting traditionally. And I still do traditional paintings. I'll do private commissions, you know, for people, which will be acrylics on canvas and that kind of stuff. So I still do that. But for the day-to-day sort of comic art, you know, it is all digital, and there's various reasons for that. You know, speed, it's easy to alter things and, you know, that kind of stuff. But yeah, I'm probably one of the rare ones that still do draw traditionally for digital art, because I know a lot of people don't even do that. You know, they'll draw it digitally and then go straight into colouring. But I still don't like the process of drawing with a pen or whatever. I still prefer to get a pencil and actually draw it traditionally. So, which is good, because I've still got, like I said, I've got shitloads of pencils I can sell. People buy penciled art still, you know. So, but yeah, that's pretty much the process.
And David, as somebody who's been a writer and an artist, I mean, earlier on you mentioned about doing your own thumbnails, but not necessarily passing them on to Nick. Do you think that gives you, and this is something I think I've talked about with Dave Gibbons, do you think that gives you a particular insight as a writer, that you've got half a mind as to how it will still look on the page? I mean, it's something that all writers have to do, but, you know, you've got actual experience of putting that physically on a page.
Yes, I hope that every script I write is doable, because, you know, I don't see how you can. I mean, there are plenty of writers who have never worked as artists, but I'm sure they must be visualizing the pages in their heads at the very least, because otherwise, why are you even doing comics? It's incredibly important to be able to visualize and it's things like knowing when you need a close up, when you need a mid shot, when you need a long shot. And it's to do with pacing, I think, as well. I mean, I see some scripts that, I mean, this is probably something to ask Nick. It may be that some people prefer a script which is basically just dialogue, and that all the decisions are going to be made by the artist. And I guess what I try to do is have a balance. I have a pretty good idea of how I think the story should be told visually. I think my technique is to kind of trick the artist into thinking they've made a decision which I've actually planted in the script.
It works because, like I say, your scripts, when I'm reading it, I'm visualizing it. And you're, like you say, you'll give a short visual description and then the dialogue that goes with each panel. And when I'm reading it and I'm visualizing the descriptive part, it's pretty much like, oh yeah, it's exactly pretty much how I would do it. It certainly, you know, it's in terms of some of the angles. And then, and I think, again, probably because you are an artist, it's the pacing that I've noticed most differently in your kind of script. It's paced really well. You'll have, you know, there'll be a big action panel, but then it'll cut to someone's close-up reaction. There's just that nice flow as you would have in a film and so on. Whereas some scripts, it might be everything's just a big moment and there's too much going on, or it's like I say, or you get a scene break where maybe it's not the best place to put it, or do you know what I mean? Or even a cause and effect, which is the worst thing when you've got in one panel multiple events happening. I mean, a classic case could be like, you know, Jed jumps through a window and does this and does this and does this all in one panel, you know, and as an artist, you're thinking, well, that's three panels to make that work, you know. So I think when I go through your scripts, I mean, it's one of the most joyous things because I can just read it and it's paced so well. It's literally, yeah, there's still a lot of work to do in terms of putting it down on the page, but a lot of it is taken care of in the sense that I can just get the flow. And I'm thinking, oh, that's a big panel. I hope the next two aren't going to be loads, but it won't be. It'll be, oh no, it's just a close-up on this panel here, or it's just a reaction shot. So it's balanced really, really well. And, you know, it's a perfect way for me to work anyway, so I can't fault it.
Okay, well, that's good to hear, because that's certainly my intention. I have to, back in the day, I'm not going to name any names, but when I was working as an artist, I did occasionally work on scripts. And I do remember once going to the editor, in fact, because I had a script that was just not doable. And although, as you said, there were multiple actions taking place in a single panel. And what was the writer told me, this, okay, it's a 5-panel page. And I went back to the editor and said, this is a 30-panel page. Can't be done. So some very strict editing had to be done on that. Similarly, there are things like the amount of dialogue you can put on a page, and I think people read more visually than they used to. When I was a kid, you would expect to have maybe 200 or 250 words to a page, because otherwise you weren't getting your money's worth. Now I always set myself an upper limit of 150 words to a page, and most pages will have probably between 75 and 100 words of dialogue or captions.
And there's also a lot of silent panels as well, which I think is brave. You know, in 10 pages, like some writers might be, oh yeah, but I've got to do some dialogue, I've got to do some writing here. But you'll have panels where it's literally, there'll be a page where there might be one panel, obviously with some dialogue, and then you'll give me three panels to just do pure storytelling, and there's no dialogue, but it creates mood and it creates, you know, not that from an artist, that's amazing, you know.
That can be slightly problematic. There have been times where I've written scenes for artists that may be like 5, 6, 7 pages, all silent panels, and people go, so what did you do then?
It's still writing.
Kind of frustrating, because actually silent panels can actually take longer to script, because you have to get... That is the one time where I sometimes... when I'm writing a script, I very occasionally will send layouts, simply because it would take so long to describe what's going to be in each silent panel. Just go, oh, sod it, here. And it may be just stick figures, but it can be easier to just send thumbnails occasionally.
You know, you mentioned your thumbnails. So how different is the final art? I mean, is there any, in terms of what you've, you know, when you're doing your thumbnails, do you look at the pages and think, oh, well, that's completely different, or some elements are similar?
It's usually pretty close, actually. And when you do, because you have occasionally, for instance, added an extra panel or combined panel.
Yeah.
And when that does happen, it's always for an improvement. And that's one of the reasons why I try not to be too pedantic with the scripts, because artists do come up with better ideas, you know. I would never want an artist to feel that they're constricted to, you know, £5 per page. It must be £5. No, it can
think
be.
It, like a lot of people said before, that the artist probably actually spends more time with the script than the writer, than anybody at the end of the day. It's because it takes longer to paint an episode than to write to some extent. So you keep gracking and you're pouring over every kind of panel. And, you know, in a sense, we probably spend the longest with that in front of us than anyone, you know.
Yeah. One of the things, one of the problems writing a script is occasionally I've had art come in where something is wrong or something is left out. And I've gone back to my script like, ah, damn it, I didn't make that specific enough. So you have to be very careful that all the important elements are in the story, are in the script.
Yeah.
Which means sometimes it does feel a little bit pedantic. You know, if I'm talking about whatever items have to be in a background or a particular angle, but I know that that's going to be significant later on.
I mean, you tend to put in bold, you know, when there's something that you know is going to be important. It's like, yeah. I get bold as like this. I think this is going to pay off later on. Got to pay attention to this particular thing. Yeah.
And the reason I do that is because I have made those mistakes in the past, you know, and it can be. Well, it's not so bad with this because I at least see the finished artwork before it goes. I don't think there's been anything that's needed changing, actually.
I thought hopefully it gives you a chance to, you can obviously, if I've maybe done something slightly different, over it, you just get a chance to change a few words here and there. Or I mean, it just makes us look better at the end of the day, I think.
Oh, sure. I always like to rewrite dialogue because you realize that if something is there in the panel visually, you don't need to spell it out. But when I was working at Marvel in particular, sometimes I wouldn't see artwork at all until it was off to the printer. And you would sometimes see disastrous errors.
Right.
And of course, it was always too late at that point to do anything about it.
I don't think all writers do that at 2000 AD. I mean, I don't know if Michael knows this, but I know John Wagner does, and I know you do, but whether they even get the chance to always see the artwork before it goes to print, because I know some people, it's literally the first time they see it is in the comic, so they've not had a chance to go back when they've seen the finished pages and think, right, I can tweak this, I can tweak that to make... I mean, it's a good way of doing it if the time allows, because obviously it just makes us look better at the end of the day because there's much more synergy then. But I don't know if Mike knows on the schedules whether all writers have a chance to do that.
I honestly don't know, to be honest with you. I'm not involved in that side of the editorial, but I know some writers, I guess it depends on timescales, you know, if an artist is right up
here. If an artist is really late, yeah.
There's no way the writer's going to get the chance to see it. But it's one of those interesting interplays in the process of making comics when it is a commercial enterprise, you know?
Yes, that's true. I was once told by an editor at Marvel, you're just part of a production line. So, I was put
in my place. That wasn't what I was implying, by the way. I wasn't putting anybody in their place.
No, I have to say, though, working with Matt Smith as editor on the magazine, I've noticed that when the printed copies come through the door, there sometimes are little changes that I didn't make, and they're always for the best. You know, it's always something that Matt has spotted needs to be emphasised or changed or whatever. I think he's really on the ball, more than most editors I've worked with. He clearly knows and understands every single character. I guess I don't know how long he's been working at Rebellion. It's a long time.
It's 20 years. I mean, he's the longest serving editor at 2000 AD.
Yeah. Well, it shows in that sense, and he really knows the job inside out. So I can't imagine that there would ever be any disastrous errors go all the way through to print.
Well, I think he's done a great job. I mean, you know, the fact that I've been allowed to sort of, you know, redesign them visually as well. You know, I really thought like it might be, oh no, you can't do that, you know, and obviously without giving much away, there's another element of that coming up in later episodes of Deliverance. And Matt's been great. He's just let me run with it. I think he just thinks, well, you know, things, different artists have different approaches. And, you know, I thought that might be a bit of a no-go area, but it's, you know, it's been great.
He's very good at the start of a story. When I send in a pitch, he's very good at spotting what may not work, or what, or the weak elements of a pitch. But once you've gone through that process and taken on board whatever suggestions he's made, he's incredibly good at just letting you run with your story then.
I mean, I think it has to be by the nature of the job of just getting the comic out to some extent. You know, ultimately, it just eats material, 2008 AD. I know the magazine's monthly, but, you know, there's such a volume of it just, you know, gets through so quick. You know, at least, you know, we have had the track record of being able to deliver on time and get it done and stuff. So it's a bit like, hopefully, yeah, I'll trust these guys, let them run with it, you know.
Just to round off the conversation, we've talked about the history of the Dark Judges, the potential for the Dark Judges, what you guys have been doing with them. If it was gloves off, no editorial mandate, no, you can't do that, just kind of pie in the sky, what you'd like to do. I guess David's already kind of mentioned this. What would be your ultimate Dark Judges story?
Well, as I said, one would be either kill all life throughout the universe, or the judges wake up one day and decide that it'd be, they just want to be nice to everybody. It'd be the two extremes, one or the other.
Yeah, I think it would have to be, well, you say the kill all life thing. I think it has to be almost, I imagine the final panel, like a final content judge death, you know, everything's extinguished and, you know, just literally massive double page spread is just there, sat, thrown or whatever, and every, you know, it's done. It's literally done. And maybe he just totally expires himself then, and everything, it's just, that's just the end, you know.
Yeah, that's probably the ultimate way to defeat him, is the kind of for the man who has everything, you know, basically get him trapped in his own head so he thinks he's killed everything.
Well, we could do it like that, so we can still do that story, and then effectively it kind of didn't actually happen, yet we still get to tell it. So I mean, that's pretty much nearly as good, isn't it? I mean, maybe for the next one.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay,
I think David's a bit sceptical about that one.
No, I don't know. I'm sceptical about whether Matt would let us go with it. But no, also, we've given away the end.
Well, there's that. Yeah. Okay.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for chatting away about this. Looking forward to seeing how Deliverance pans out, and more gore. And,
oh yes, there will be. There will be gore.
Watching through space.
Well, thank you so much to David and to Nick for talking about the Dark Judges Deliverance, not Judge Dredd. I wasn't going to re-record the entire intro just because of that. Anyway, we're going to be back in a week's time. Make sure that you check out the schedule for Thought Bubble, which is one of our favorite conventions, and it's something that's moved online for obvious reasons. We've not only got plenty of our creators lined up for various panels, but also we've got the 2080 talent searches. Doing things a little bit differently this time. The art competition and the script competition, people have sent their entries in. We've put together some shortlists, and we're going to have judges going through those and choosing who gets to work at 2080. Incredible prizes. Best prizes in comics. So make sure you check out the schedule for that, middle of November, for one of the best comic shows now online and free. So we'll see you in a week's time. Take care, look after yourselves, wrap up warm, and until next time Earthlets, Splung the Verthrick.
Fell power levels dangerously high. Alert! Alert! Read 2000 AD every week. Ask your comic book store or newsagent now. Subscribe to the galaxy's greatest comic at 2000adonline.com.